as I said, we're going to be talking about the 10 virgins today. And I was lucky to run across a tape that kind of had some settings of some of Jesus' parables, some of the things that he may have, that people would have been in people's minds when they listened to the parable. It's actually a historian that went to Judea, took a group with him, and talked about some of these things and parables and gave a little history, a little background, and I thought that might help us as we start this to kind of bear that in mind, because it's important to kind of get into shoes of a regular Jew from that period of time and kind of understand where things are coming from. So bear with me as I try to get this working again here.
If my record continues to be that of a conservative Republican, I also think Greeks lived, and to the northeast over here, Gamla, where the Zealot movement had started and the very passionately anti-Roman nationalistic spirit was up in those particular mountains. From about where Mount Arbel starts over there, around in this direction to where we are, and on to the east a ways, is the area where Jesus spent most of his ministry. Capernaum, right down at the bottom of the hill here, and 3 miles away or so, Bethsaida, Chorazin, a couple miles up this way, and in that triangle, the Bible says Jesus performed most of his miracles. Just to the north of the Mount of Beatitudes are the ruins of the ancient city of Chorazin, one of the cities where Jesus' ministry was focused. To better understand his teaching and the context where that teaching took place, we went together as a group and sat in the ruins of that ancient city. Welcome to Chorazin, the northern city of the triangle in which Jesus conducted his ministry. Typically black basalt city, like you've come to expect here in the Galilee. Several things here of interest and that you might want to take a look at also later, but number one is the synagogue. You recognize kind of the frieze up there along on the columns. What's especially fascinating about this one is this is the one in which they found the only known example of a Moses seat on which the person who was reading the Torah scroll sat. In the upper end of the city, they've got some reconstructed houses. And you can see what they did here is they provided something called fenestrations. You'll notice some places where either they have arches in the house or they have something that looks like a whole row of little windows. These basalt stones are very brittle and they won't go a long distance. If you make them over about 5 feet long, they just crack. They can't bear their own weight. So they had to divide the rooms up into about 5-foot sections in order to have roof beams. I'm looking at the floor, an authentic original floor here, and thinking about Jesus' parable of the lost coin. You can imagine how if you dropped a coin on your floor, that it could easily go, you know, between one of the cracks in the rock like that, and it was gone. So the woman, of course, swept her house looking for the coin. She finally found it. That's the kind of floor we're talking about. Let me give you a brief scriptural lesson that we're going to add on to in a couple of other places, but I wanted to do one part of it here because this is so authentic, and it dates back to that early period. In those days, when you married, you did not build a new home normally or rent an apartment. What you did is you built onto dad's house. And if you were a girl, you went to your husband's dad's house. And so you see an example here of a typical Jewish house complex called an insula, I-N-S-U-L-A. It was built around an open courtyard, and I'm in the open courtyard. Place for kids to play, you can cook, you can have an animal or your animals or whatever, just an open courtyard. To each side, housing complexes. This large room here in the middle, that's the original house. And who knows how many people lived in there, 5, 8, 10, 15, I don't know. Houses were very small. You didn't have a lot of room. Now the oldest son gets married, and so he adds an addition, let's say. I'm not saying that's actually this house, but he adds an addition, and that's his house. Now the next son, he's there, and pretty soon the first grandson, and he's in the back. That's his house back there, and then another grandson, and pretty soon you start building on this side. And you see the same principle here, a whole series of houses connected to each other that eventually become the family complex. When it was time for a guy and girl to be married, a girl married at 14, 15 years of age, and a guy maybe in his mid-20s, the two families would get together, they would negotiate the bride price. When they had assigned the bride price, they would exchange a glass of wine, and that would seal the bargain. They're now committed to be married. At that point, the young man would say to his bride, "I'm going to go home to my father's house and prepare a place for you. And when I've prepared a place for you, I'll come back and take you to be with me as my wife." In other words, I got to go home to Dad's insula. Now, at that point, the girl had no idea when the wedding was going to be. Might be 6 months, might be 9 months, might be a year, might be 2 years. She just had to be ready at any given moment. She was called one who had been bought with a price. Paul uses that to describe us. He says, you are bought at a price. You are a bride-to-be. You have to be faithful to your bridegroom because he's going to come back for you. Where is your bridegroom today? He's preparing a place for you. And that comes right out of the context of this marriage example where the son would say, "I'm going to go to my father's house and prepare a place for you." Interesting that we know that the son, of course, was very anxious to come back and get his bride. He wanted to be married. I mean, that's what the whole thing was about. So he probably went to his dad and said, "Well, Dad, how about today?" "No, come on, son. This is your wedding. You can't just run out and leave a half minute. Finish it. Get it right." Somebody asked Jesus, "When is your second coming? When will you come back for your bride, the church?" And Jesus says, "No one knows the day or the hour of my return. Not the angels in heaven, not the Son, only my Father knows." Eventually, of course, it's finished. So the son goes to Dad and says, "Dad, is it ready yet?" Dad says, "Okay." So the son gets all his friends and he goes to the girl's house. And they blow the trumpet, the shofar, to announce the wedding. And every girl in town thought, "My wedding." Of course, it was only one girl's. But every girl had to suddenly rush around, get her bridesmaids' dresses ready, get her wedding dress ready, get all of her stuff together that she had prepared. And you remember Jesus' parable of the wise and foolish bridesmaids, some of whom were ready, some of whom weren't. They would gather in this courtyard. The groom and his wife would go into the house. The best man would stand here by the door and wait while they consummated the wedding. And the guests all stood and waited. When it was consummated, the best man would come into the courtyard, get everybody's attention. "Now your attention, they're married." Everybody would cheer, and then the reception would begin, and it would be a 7-day wedding reception. John the Baptist says, the friend stands at the door listening for the bridegroom's voice. And he says, that privilege is mine. I've heard his voice. He doesn't say he's married yet, because Jesus was only here for the engagement the first time. He says, I heard his voice. He's here. Jesus comes, engages himself to you, and he says, I love you. I'll pay the bride price. His own life. Then he said to you, in my Father's house are many rooms. Big insula. But we're not, so I would have told you, I'm going to go to my Father's house and prepare a place for you. And I will come again and take you to be with me forever.
So for a Jew listening to these parables, you know, Jesus filled it full of things that they understood and that meant something to them. And as the tapes and other tapes that I read, I mean, the Bible lands and that time period was very rich in culture and, you know, things going on. Things that we don't really understand, things that really sometimes are kind of stale by the time we get them and we read about them. But I wanted to show that to you just to kind of get
everybody kind of in the mindset of when Jesus was talking to them and he read this and he told them this parable. Beginning of the parable of the 10 virgins, it says at that time, I went ahead and that kind of, it starts out at that time, and it's a continuation of a thought. So I thought I'd go back to the beginning of where this kind of idea starts, and that is starting in Matthew chapter 24, 36. And I'm just going to read this to you. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Going on down to Matthew 24:42, says, therefore keep watch, because you do not know what day your Lord will come. And then in 24, starting in 45, it says, who then is the faithful and wise servant, whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household, to give them their food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, my master is staying away a long time. And he then begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on the day when he does not expect him and at an hour he is not aware of. He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. At that time, going into the parable, the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 were foolish and 5 were wise. The foolish ones took the lamp and did not take any oil with them. The wise, however, took oil in jars along with their lamps. The bridegroom was a long time in coming, and they all became drowsy and fell asleep. At midnight, the cry rang out, here is the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. Then all the virgins woke up, trimmed their lamps. The foolish ones said to the wise, give us some of your oil. Our lamps are going out. No, they replied, there may not be enough for both of us and you. Instead, go to those who sell oil and buy some for yourselves. But while they were on their way to buy the oil, the bridegroom arrived. The virgins who were ready went in with him to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Later, the others came in. Sir, sir, they said, open the door for us. But he replied, I tell you the truth, I do not know you. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know the day or the hour. As I was saying before, all these parables have kind of a central truth to them. And there are pieces in this parable that, have some meaning. But they all kind of point to the central truth, which, when you see therefore, it's a big red line or a big underlining thing saying this is the conclusion. Therefore, keep watch because you do not know the hour, day or the hour. Going through the book, I noticed that it went through and it described a lot of the pieces of the parable. And I'm going to go ahead and go through what the book said, what was kind of thought and understood by the writer. But bear in mind that these are all pointing toward the central theme, the central conclusion of the parable, and that is to keep watch, to be ready, to be vigilant. In the book it said, the custom of this parable still exists in the East. And I want to first start off by asking a question. Who do you think is meant by the virgins in this book, in this story? What do you think they were, maybe Jesus was alluding to in context with the main theme? Yeah, us, right. People who are waiting in expectation for God to come. The writer of the book I was studying says virginity pretty much in every culture is a profession of purity. And in this case, he alludes that this may indicate that talking profession of somebody that has a profession of pure faith, the soul guiltless of apostasy from God. By these virgins, then, we are to understand all who profess to be waiting for the Son of God from heaven, and who do not by their deeds openly deny that hope. They all took lamps when they went to the bridegroom. They were all waiting on the bridegroom. But then it says, but five were wise, five were foolish. You know, there again, I don't want to take a piece of this and make a theology out of it, you know. But I want to, it's food for thought here. These virgins, they were waiting for God to come. And all of them were. You know, all of them were waiting for the bridegroom. So we're talking about the kingdom of God here. They were all waiting for God to come. But five are called wise, and five are called foolish.
I think it's interesting that he does give us virgins there instead of, I mean, he doesn't say all the old men and the old women were waiting for the feast to start,
uh-huh.
The marriage was consecrated, and because these are the people, I can think in my own case that I looked at weddings a lot differently when I was single than I do now. Particularly when my kids get married now, sometimes it's more of a drudgery than it is a time of joy. Although when a couple of them get married, I think it will be a time of joy. But the virgins would look upon a wedding as something for them to look forward to as well,
mm-hmm.
rather than something that's I'm just going to the wedding to enjoy the feast and to enjoy the wine and to enjoy the food and everything. But I'm excited about this because that's
going to
be me someday.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's even today, I remember back when I used to room with Ron before I got married, and we finally figured out that all the girls that, you know, were actually available turned out at weddings. And none of us, whenever we were invited to a wedding, we were like, oh, man, we have to sit through another wedding. Finally, we figured out, but, you know, so that kind of applies today, you know. A lot of young women like going to weddings, and that's something there again, you know. There's a little truth there that, you know, we can take with it that heaven is something to look forward to.
I have a question. If we're going to interpret the ten virgins as the people who are prepared, basically staying pure and are ready, they have the lamp, they're the ones that, I mean, if you're all these other parables that you've been looking mm-hmm. at, and half of them don't make it. Because, you know, you get further
right.
down, I mean, you get later on, and he says, I don't know you.
Right.
So, from all outward appearances,
they appear to be,
same.
Yes,
they appear
exactly.
the same. But, by half of them were not prepared.
And there again, I mean, I think it's definitely something to think about in the sense that, you know, examine your heart. You know, examine your heart. Probably would know if you were pretty much kind of going through the motions with it all and not really into it. Now, I don't want to make a theology out of this. This is something that it's food for thought, and I think we need to take it in context of the whole parable. So let me just see if we can go through this and see kind of what we kind of come up with here.
Question.
Yeah.
What's the, again, maybe this is the point of what we're going to get to in the study, but You know, I guess, what is the criteria for sort of where you end with all of the allegory and the analogies mm-hmm. between, you know, interpreting what certain things mean in a parable? I mean, because it's obvious that things in the parable have meaning, like the virgins are us, the bridegroom is Christ, and the father is God, but then you could take it the next step and say, well, you know, half of them weren't allowed in, so mm-hmm. does that mean 50% of the people in the world won't be allowed
no.
in, you know? And, I mean, yeah. I guess there's got, what I'm trying to understand is where, in order to talk to people about, because people do that to the Bible, the, mm-hmm. they sort of
pick it apart
to the next level and say, well, yeah, it says 50%, you know. What is God, or what is Christ doing in heaven, right? What is the preparation he's making for us? And you could develop a whole theory mm-hmm. on that. So,
one thing that I have found to be true is that whenever a passage, when you take a passage out of context and you start making conclusions out of it, it cannot contradict the rest of the Bible and what the New Testament says in truth. So, for example, you could come up with a false conclusion that it's by works and not by complete works on your own and not through salvation from Christ that you're saved, and that by this parable. You could make that wrong conclusion out of this by stretching the point. But we know that we're saved through Christ's death. So there again, you don't want to take things out of context and start making conclusions and theology out of it.
Well, and I think that was the point I was wanting to make, because I'm not sure that we should say that the virgins are the church. Because if you're looking at these other, the whole thread of teaching, so this chunk of teaching that he's doing for about four chapters here, he's basically talking about being prepared.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about the fact that life looks the same. You've got two guys in the field doing the same job. One goes, one stays. You've got
mm-hmm.
two people in the bed together. One goes, one stays. You've got 10 virgins prepared for a wedding. Five go, five stay. And maybe it's a 50-50. Maybe that's a 50-50. But just the whole concept of being, that life goes on, common everyday things, and don't get hung up in doing your work, being ready for
right.
the next party, the next wedding, because you don't know when he's going to come and he's going to call his own.
Right.
The preparedness to me is what, you know, is the main thing here. Like I said, I'm kind of with this guy that, how do you know which things to pick and interpret? I think your overall view is what we need to be looking at. Don't pick just one chapter,
right.
one verse, but look at what is the teaching that's happening in these pages.
And there is a big danger in doing that, because there have been theologies that have been developed around certain parables which were totally false.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing is to get, like Joel said, to get the overall flavor of what God is trying to say, and you've done exactly that. Be prepared. That's what it is. Now, why did he choose 5 and 5? Probably because it was very simple for everybody to understand. I mean, if he came out and said there were virgins at the wedding and 78.6% of them were wise, and 17.4% were foolish. Everybody would all of a sudden start going, let's see, let me calculate that out. And the real peasants who didn't know how to calculate themselves had no idea what that means.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it could be something, it probably is something as simple as that. But I think you're right. To dwell on the 5 wise and the 5 foolish is probably not what Jesus intended us to do in this particular parable. He intended us to see the preparedness.
But one thing that the five does, these people are sincere, and again, I'm not trying to get into specifics of our numbers, but they're sincere people. You know, they're all sincere. And five, kind of like, whoa, you know, that's quite a bit that are sincere, who are supposed to be ready, just not this day. To me, that makes a pretty big impact to me today, because I'm thinking, well, what does it mean? Sincerity in and of itself doesn't. You know, it'd be like, well, 99, you know, I think he said, well, 99 and only one, but, well, that's one thing, you know, I don't want to worry too much. But when he does say 50%, that's a big chunk. And all these people would be
think you're right. Just a minute. A lot of people probably will fall in the category of being sincere, maybe. We could say that. And then a lot of people, maybe, we could say. 50%, I mean, if we had put an exact number to it, then we'd have people creating theologies around those numbers. We see that a lot of times with 144 in Revelation. But then by saying 50-50, it's just, you immediately recognize it's just a number that he threw out there.
I think about Micah, that problem. As well, he says, the sheep to his right and the goats to his left. He said, I never knew you. You know, he said, calling them workers of iniquity, workers of wickedness.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they were in the church, their deeds were wicked. Their sacrifice to God was self-seeking. And he said, they asked him, said, Lord, when did we see you when you were naked? And when did we see you when you were poor? He said, you know, you did it not to the least of my little ones, you've done it not unto me. And the ones that he told to come on his right hand, come in. Because they watched over the people that most people would reject because of their own personal outlook of what a person is. We never know what a person's life is or what a person is going through. But if we let Christ really roll it through in our hearts for what we ought to be in God, you know, we learned that we're following Jesus' footsteps. Jesus watched over the poor, the afflicted. He hung around the tax collectors. He didn't discriminate a person because of what their position was, whether it was high or low. But sometimes in Christianity, we based our conversation and our association on what a person got. And sometimes we do it unconsciously. We put our surrounding on people like me. I want to be around more people that think like I think, that act like I act, and we discard everybody else that's not in our circle, our comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing that, we only get a little bit of what God is saying in His Word. So we have to constantly keep having someone teach us how to get the fundamental of what God is trying to teach us. So He says, go to the highways and the streets where they sell it at, because they don't have enough oil to carry them over because they haven't learned to walk in the faith of God to really learn how to love everybody unconditionally. So when the time of Christ tarrying, they get caught back in doing what they want to do. They relax. They don't have no oil. They don't have no real faith on trusting God to reach out to everybody. They limit their reach out because of maybe the neighborhood they live in, the community they live in. They're not going in the ghetto. They're not, some people in the ghetto are not going to go in the rich neighborhood. They limit themselves for what God can do for them.
Right, and it's important to keep in mind that we come through Christ, we come to Christ, come through our salvation through Christ. He is the way, the truth, and the life. And by following His example, that's where we have it together, basically, maybe spiritually, maybe you might say. And that's important to make it your conviction, to look within your heart and examine your life. That's where the parable comes into meaning. It's where you make it applicable to you. And am I really earnestly doing what God commands? It is, I don't want to stray off the beaten path, but this is good stuff here. It's a covenant that we have with God. You know, Christ is saving us. We, in turn, are basically giving our lives for Christ. He gave His life for us. We're giving our lives for Him. And, you know, that's pretty much, you know, you might say it's in a nutshell.
I guess you could say it like this. If you have love for one another, you have all things. If you have not love for one another, you have nothing at all. It has no difference what you may accumulate in this world and this wealth.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have the love of God in your heart to have that kind of love unconditionally for everybody else, you're not going to make it.
in the book, it basically was saying that it alluded this thought, talking about the virgins and this idea, it alluded to a controversy between two schools of thought, the Romanist and the Reformers. The Reformers asserting that it was the living principle of faith that was lacking in the ten virgins, and the Romanist affirming that they had faith, but their works basically was dead. There again, you know, we don't want to make theology with this, but we want to hone in on being prepared for God and His coming.
The other question too is, what distinguishes a foolish and a wise person? What makes you prepared?
I was thinking about, maybe we sort of minimize what the word ready means or prepared means, because, I mean, to one extent you sort of think it just means to wait. Mm-hmm. And that's what the foolish virgin said. They waited, but they left their lamps burning, you know, and so they didn't have any oil. If you look at what, you know, like, what be prepared means for Boy Scouts, I mean, it means that you're learning all of the skills that you need to be prepared for any situation, and that's, I think, what the be prepared, be ready means, and what the point of all this is, that you're not just sitting around letting your lamp burn, you're preparing yourself. They were supposed to be preparing themselves to become brides mentally, whatever else that entailed, not just wasting oil.
Right, and you're what you said there kind of jumps to an idea the book talked about. What about which opens up a question, what about these virgins that were sleeping? You know, it may mean that they felt like they had done everything that they thought was needed in order to meet the bridegroom. They calmly and securely awaited his coming. You know, being comfortable, I don't want to make a theology than saying that, you know, one way, you know, we don't want to stretch this out, but being comfortable with your faith and where you are isn't a wise move, I would say. You know, learning, constantly feeding yourself, growing in your faith, learning from others, practicing what you learn, you know, that helps you learn even more. It helps take root of what, you know, God's trying to teach you. You know, it's not, you know, it, that's what it is. Learn.
I was just thinking on Jesus, for example, when he was praying, and you know he's going to be crucified for our sins, he prayed till he sweated blood. And he really didn't want to take them as up on him anymore, because he's seen how wicked we were as people. Mm-hmm. And but yet he said, not my will, thy will be done. Mm-hmm. He surrendered to God's will. And I think when we no longer surrender to God's will in our life, we want to take that. We got the right to take our will back anytime we want to. Do what we want to do. Mm-hmm. But I think when we surrender to God's will completely in our life and be more like Christ surrendered his will all the way to death, I think that's where we should be really reaching, to surrender everything about us and to let God really rule in our lives. And it's hard sometimes because we got, speak for myself. I have a challenge. My challenge is what Paul was saying. Oh, what wretched man am I? Mm-hmm. The good that I would do that I do not. But thank God for Jesus Christ, who's able to help me to learn how to surrender my will and my life to God. But if I don't submit my life to God and surrender my will to God, well, then I'm walking on my own accord and my own understanding and my own wisdom and my own thoughts. And God's thoughts are higher than man's thoughts. Therefore, I can't even begin to understand what God is saying because I got too many human point of views on it and not surrendered to God's will completely. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I am lost regardless of how bound I may think I am, because I'm no longer walking in the Spirit of God. I'm walking on man's human standards and viewpoints of life.
The section on talking about the virgins in particular, concludes that the foolish virgins are those going through a round of external duties, if possible, without life in what they were doing. Those confessing with their lips but not diligent in the acts of humility and charity, and basically, I would add, truly having Jesus as the Lord of their life, is some possibilities of what, you know, you could draw from this. They had an outward expression of Christ, the lamp. But what was inward and spiritual as being the oil, they didn't have enough. There's a lot of, you know, there's some verses here where, talking about the Jewish faith, and coming from a Jewish standpoint, oil is referred to as a symbol of faith, both in Exodus, when they're being instructed, some of the things that they burn, in Exodus 30, 22 through 33, Zechariah 4:2 refers to the olive tree as being a source of faith, spirit. It's all, you know, that's the theme that it's kind of talking about. You know, that, you know, it's all speaking to them, you know, it's speaking to them as far as, you know, what their faith is. We didn't get through everything that I wanted to get through. What I'm thinking about doing is going ahead with this, because there were some, and maybe we can move a little faster and get done with it, but I may reread the parable again next time, because there were some other things that were kind of brought out in the book, and then we can get on to maybe a smaller parable next week too, kind of get that in too. So that's kind of what I'm thinking. I might change my mind when I get to studying some stuff, but if I do change my mind, I will briefly go over kind of some of the points that I thought was kind of really good that the book made.